Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to the Rose Report by Rose Law Group. This is a legal podcast that will focus on the relevant legal issues embedded in current events, impacting you, your family, and business. Our goal is to inform, engage, and curate content based on your interests, so please connect with us so we can make that a reality. This podcast is affiliated with Rose Law Group, a full-service law firm based in Scottsdale, Arizona, that focuses on real estate, land use and zoning, immigration, litigation, COVID-19, business and corporate transactions, government affairs, family law, and many other areas. Some of the larger concepts our firm is known for are innovation and service. This podcast aims to continue to build on these larger ideas. And now for host introductions, starting with myself, I'm Wafa Shahid. I am the social media director for Rose Law Group. I'm a journalist by trade with experience reporting in several markets. I've covered a range of issues from politics on Capitol Hill to local elections and state issues. I'm absolutely stoked to be a host on this podcast. I will be providing the background and context on the current events we discuss. And just a little about me, I'm a voracious reader. I love a good mystery, especially. When I'm not in the office, you can find me in the gym or cuddling with my cat named Duchess.
Hey everyone, I'm Dan Goth here. I'm a real estate and business transactional attorney. I handle a wide range of real estate matters, from commercial real estate transactions, including development, financing, and leasing, to property and land use issues. Outside of real estate, I regularly advise my business owner clients on a variety of business issues that businesses encounter on a daily basis. Some common and some unique. Lots of disputes between business owners and partners, issues related to raising capital, risk and liability mitigation, and lots more. When I'm not practicing law, you can probably find me in my backyard playing fetch with my dogs, Rue and Jax, or playing board games more now than ever. Our goal with this podcast is to provide a platform to discuss important legal issues arising from current events, and doing so in a palatable way that is accessible to non-lawyers.
And I'm Olin Lennitz. I'm a litigator with Rose Law Group. Along with handling civil litigation matters such as landlord-tenant disputes, HOA issues, contract enforcement, and other common law causes of action, I defend clients in criminal defense matters stemming from property and traffic crimes. When I'm not thinking about the law, I'm likely binge-watching TV or playing adult ice hockey. I'm also a dad to two cats and a dog, as well as a perfect seven-month-old girl named Mila. I hope that, along with Dan and Wafa, we can parse out various legal principles in a way which makes them digestible to all listeners, providing an education to the everyday listener and hopefully a platform for substantive discussion for legal peers.
All right. Thanks, guys, for that. And with that, we're going to go ahead and dive into our content for today. So today we're going to talk about COVID-19 and a thing called force majeure, and we'll get into exactly what that is. So first off, as you guys probably already know and you've heard about constantly in the news cycle, the COVID-19 pandemic has undoubtedly altered our lives in one way or another. As of today, now we're recording this on May 17th, the CDC reports that there are 1,467,065 cases of COVID-19 in the U.S., with 88,709 deaths, and a total of 31,967 new cases. Now, in Arizona, we're lucky that things aren't as bad compared to other spots in the country. According to the Arizona Department of Health, as of today, again, May 17th, there are 13,937 cases of COVID-19 in Arizona, with 680 total deaths and a total of 306 new cases. Estimates show that COVID-19 shut down up to a third of our economy in the shortest amount of time in history, according to Berkeley statistics. Now, this has caused damage that economists around the world are really still trying to account for and calculate in their long-term projections of where we're going. Even though lockdowns are starting to get lifted in parts of the country, especially in Arizona, questions about fulfilling contractual obligations still remain. Because the fact of the matter is that the economy is still suffering and many people are still struggling to make ends meet. Many business owners, property owners, and also tenants on the other side of the equation are questioning how to navigate these contractual issues. That's where force majeure comes in. So just a quick definition for you, force majeure is a legal term that is seen in contracts. And what it does is it protects both parties involved in a contract from circumstances that are beyond their control. So, for example, we have things like natural disasters, pandemics, and other unforeseen situations. And with that, Olin and Dan will give us some more details.
Thanks, Wafa. So, Black's Law Dictionary defines force majeure as an event or effect that can be neither anticipated nor controlled. It is a contractual provision allocating the risk of loss if performance becomes impossible or impracticable, especially as a result of an event that parties could not have anticipated or controlled. Now, more narrowly, the Arizona Revised Statutes, or ARS, have defined force majeure as an act of God or of nature, a superior or overpowering force, or an event or effect that cannot be reasonably anticipated or controlled. And that comes out of Title 33, which focuses on property. And finally, more narrowly, an Arizona court in 2016 interpreted the force majeure clause as an equitable legal principle pursuant to which a party to a contract whose performance has been made physically and or economically impossible or at least impracticable due to circumstances totally beyond his control can be given certain types of relief. And as you notice, a common phrase there is outside of control. A party or both parties are unable to control the events that are now causing an impact on that contract. And I think Dan has a little more on the history of that.
Yeah, thanks, Olin. And the history of force majeure is pretty interesting. So the concept of force majeure dates way back to Roman and French law. But in the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court adopted force majeure in a case in 1883. The case was called In the Tornado. In that case, in 1883, the Supreme Court determined that the owner of a ship named the Tornado was not required to deliver freight on his vessel as he was required to do by a contract because the ship had accidentally caught fire before the ship commenced voyage and was rendered unseaworthy. So the parties in this case had specifically agreed that the Tornado would deliver the freight. But obviously, since there was a fire and the ship couldn't sail, the Tornado couldn't deliver the goods. And we had a sort of impossibility situation as Olin referenced just a minute ago. On top of that, the two parties in this case didn't include a force majeure provision. So there was nothing governing what would happen in this sort of event. So as I referenced earlier, the Supreme Court in this case pulled a rule from an England case called Taylor v. Caldwell that said, when two parties contemplate a specific set of circumstances to occur and that those set of circumstances can no longer be performed, both parties are excused for performance. And in this case, again, it was the fire that caused the ship to be unable to sail. The parties had not contemplated that happening. So therefore, the court said, okay, well, we'll excuse performance in this case. And so I think, you know, now that we've sort of covered the background and, you know, what force majeure is, let's talk practical implications. Olin, what's the benefit of having a force majeure clause? 30,000 foot view me.
So yeah, the benefit of having a force majeure clause is that it allows a party to suspend or terminate the performance of its obligations when circumstances beyond that party's control arise, and those circumstances make performance of whatever duty it has in that contract inadvisable, commercially impracticable, illegal, or impossible.
So, Olin, what happens when you don't have a force majeure clause?
Well, when you don't have a force majeure clause, then you are deemed in breach of whatever contract, and you need to go to a court and have the judge or jury decide that, no, in fact, the performance was rightfully suspended or not performed, and essentially it becomes a legal matter incurring fees and time, and it becomes a mess.
Let's maybe walk through a quick example. And this is sort of on the fly, but you know, maybe it's helpful for our listeners to hear a quick example. So let's say that you know, I am building a, Olin, you hire me to build you a house. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm a general contractor and I go to get all the materials and start building the house. Let's say it's going to take 6 months to do. 3 months in, we have a labor shortage. Let's say, you know, Wafa, you're one of my subcontractors on the job. And for one reason or another, you're unable to find people to work for you. And we can't get the job done in a timely manner because of, you know, the shortage in labor. You know, what happens in that case? What right do you have, Olin, as a homeowner? What right do I have as a contractor under our contract?
Well, I mean, the first part of that, and you know, the very lawyer answer is it depends. And the first thing anyone would do is look at the underlying contract that I have with you and see what provisions we have in there about the performance. I know you said that you're 3 months into a six month project, but is that 6 month project the estimate you gave me and said this should be done in 6 months? Or did I tell you, Dan, I need this done in 6 months because that's when I have to move in? So one, materiality of that timeline is very important to figure out if there's actually, or not if, but how bad the delay or the stoppage is. Then next you would look if there is some sort of force majeure clause, if it relates to why you are unable to continue performing. So if the reason that WAFA's subcontracting business isn't able to provide you with what you contracted with them for, that may have an impact on our agreement because she might have a reason that was contemplated for or covered by this catch-all provision of, you know, natural disasters or civil unrest, or as we're going to talk about and likely see in the future, viral pandemics.
Yeah, that's a good point. So maybe, you know, if I'm hearing what you're saying and just sort of taking it out a little bit, if my contract with WAFA, let's say it guaranteed that there, you know, under terms of strict performance of the contract, that WAFA would provide that labor in a timely manner, because it was clear when I hired her that I needed to get the job done for you in 6 months. In that sense, you know, what I think would probably happen is, you know, the force majeure could probably not be exercised in that case because it was within the party's expectations that something could happen, and they accounted for that by saying, no, you need to perform on time regardless of what might, you know, happen or what might pop up.
Right, unless there was a specific provision in that contract that says, well, you know, we're building this this home on the California coast and it's prone to have, you know, earthquakes. And so if there's an earthquake, you understand, Dan, that my business, WAFA's business, is unable to perform due to the potential effects an earthquake may have. And you say, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Obviously, if an earthquake happens and you can't finish in a six-month period, that's understood, that's excusable. We'll address that if and when it happens, but that will not be immediately deemed a breach.
One other thing that kind of comes to mind with this whole situation is, you know, yes, we can have these adjustments in the contracts, but you know, how many times can we make these adjustments? Say, you know, you get a 6 month extension or something like that. Maybe that's worked into the contract. What if you need another 6 months? How many times can we make adjustments to these contracts? And is that something that's going to be included in future force majeure clauses?
Well, I think that's a broader question that doesn't specifically apply to force majeure. A party two parties are free to amend and restructure their agreement as many times as they want. In fact, most contracts have another provision in them that specifically contemplates that, you know, this is the final and only version of this agreement, unless in writing we both agree to amend it in the future. And so what force majeure, I guess it doesn't necessarily give you a new seat at the table to restructure the contract. It just says that your performance under the contract is excused if this happens, no questions asked. And at that point, and something Dan and I have both been seeing a lot in this COVID pandemic, is that we're seeing landlords and tenants come to us and say, hey, we probably don't have a good enough force majeure clause, but the tenant or the landlord, whoever they are, has come to me and we're trying to restructure this. And if a force majeure event occurred, what you would likely see is the parties go back to the table, renegotiate, sit back down and figure out, all right, this is what it's looking like. Let's restructure this. But it's not an obligation, nor is it something that has a specific amount of, you know, attempts or instances before you're kind of out of luck and the contract either has to be performed or terminated or breached or whatever.
Yeah, unless the force majeure clause says otherwise, right? I mean, I don't think I've ever seen this, but I'm just spitballing here. You know, if the force majeure clause says that, you know, not more than once every 12 months during the term of this contract or something like that, right? That would limit the amount of times where you could try to exercise your rights under that force majeure clause. But you know, more broadly, Olin, I agree with what you're saying. You know, most of the time, practically speaking, what happens is the parties come back together and they say, hey, look, you know, I can't perform. I have this right under force majeure. I think it's legitimate, but you know, it doesn't make sense for us to, you know, pursue that, at least legally. Let's just sit down and retrade to the extent necessary to account for these new unforeseen circumstances.
On the point that you just made about, you know, unless there's a specific provision in the force majeure that says once in 12 months, I honestly, I've never thought of it this way, but I don't even know if that would stand up in court. I mean, do you think that a court would uphold a clause that restricts that when the entire purpose and spirit of the clause is unforeseeability? I don't know if you could even put a restriction on the potentials, because that's the whole spirit of that provision is we don't know what's going to happen. So if it happens, here's what we do from there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great point.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Thanks guys.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of saying, yeah, it's sort of saying like, you know, we're acknowledging that, you know, the events in this paragraph are outside the party's control, but then we're putting a handcuff on it that puts it back within the party's control.
Well, here's another thing that comes up is, you know, say we do have, you know, opposing parties who are trying to work things out, trying to adjust their clause. You know, what if people can't come to an agreement? What if there isn't an agreement? You know, where do both parties go from there? How does that pan out?
So I think it depends on where you are in the process, if you're one of those people negotiating the contract. So if it's at the outset, you know, let's say, you know, I'm negotiating a lease on behalf of a client, landlord and tenant. Let's say I'm working for the tenant and Olin's working for the landlord. And so, you know, we're lawyers advising our clients on how to include a proper force majeure clause, right? And if, you know, frankly, I've never had this experience. Olin, I don't know if you have, but, you know, I've never had a contract fall apart in the negotiation phase because of a failure to agree on terms for force majeure. I don't know how big of a risk that is. I'd say it's probably pretty low.
Yeah. So I've never seen that, but it's funny that you mention it because that is something that maybe in the future we will have to kind of butt heads with opposing counsel in negotiating, because, you know, what we're seeing with this COVID-19 response is there's a very broad spectrum of people and how seriously they're taking it, how genuine they think it might be. And so I think, it's interesting you mentioned that. I hadn't thought about it, but I feel like if I am in the future trying to advocate for a specific viral pandemic force majeure provision, I could foresee pushback saying, no, that's bogus. That's not even a real thing. I'm not going to worry about that.
Yeah, no, and I will give you an actual real life example of this sort of coming to a T. You know, I had a commercial real estate transaction that closed a couple of weeks ago. In that transaction, we had to enter into, we basically had to amend the agreement that governed the transaction. And in that amendment, what I did and what I recommended was to add in a contingency related to COVID-19, not really a force majeure clause because it wasn't appropriate in that place, but that's how, you know, practically it would play out. And opposing counsel, the lawyer on the other side, negotiated that provision with me. It wasn't a, you know, an overreaching provision, but we had to settle and agree on how long one party could delay based on COVID-19 and what, you know, standard of proof, for lack of a better way to explain it, does the party looking to delay have to show before they can delay performing, before they can delay buying the property or whatever it is. In that case, that's what it was.
Well, yeah. And I think what's interesting about that example that you mentioned is, as we'll, I'm sure, talk about in the future as well, just general contract provisions, you're free to bargain for whatever you want. So I'm sure if it was going to get contentious, which, you know, it sounds like it's good it didn't, but it could have been a very rigorous, you know, I need a notarized letter from your doctor or, you know, some healthcare professional saying that you are at risk and that, or, you know, you're a care person for someone who's contracted it or at risk. And without that, I won't give you this, you know, this break on performance. So that's just, I guess, another interesting, facet of this is everything is, you know, you're able to bargain for everything. And, it really depends on the party that you're working to enter into a contract with or amend the contract with. And as we both know, oftentimes their counsel as well, to see how demanding or how, agreeable those provisions are going to ultimately wind up being.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for that little segment on the practical implications of having one or not having one. Now we're going to go into a few examples. So I'm going to read a good force majeure clause and I'm going to read a bad one. I'm not going to say which is which. And then Dan and Olin are going to pick them apart.
Sounds good.
So here's the first one. Other than parties' obligations under this agreement that can be performed by the payment of money whenever a period of time is prescribed in this agreement for action to be taken by either party and without negligence of the party otherwise chargeable with breach or default, such party will not be liable or responsible for and therefore will be excluded from the computation of any such period of time, any delays due to strikes, riots, natural disasters, acts of God, shortages of labor or materials, war, terrorist attacks or activities, governmental laws, regulations, or restrictions, which are beyond the control of such party and cause such party to be unable to perform its obligations as prescribed in this agreement. The party otherwise chargeable with the breach or default will, as soon as reasonably practicable, endeavor to notify the other party of the occurrence of any event specified in this paragraph, provided that such party shall incur no liability for failure to do so. Woo, okay, that was example one.
That's a lot of words.
Now, right? Yeah, you guys. Now, example two. Notwithstanding anything to the contrary contained herein, neither party shall be liable for any delays or failures in performance resulting from acts beyond its reasonable control. Okay, now that I read these two segments, hopefully you're still listening, but there's a few questions I want you guys to think about. When you think of both segments, think about the scope, think about the things that are mentioned in these agreements, before we have Dan and Olin kind of break it down for us. All right. Now, hopefully you've thought about that and gathered your thoughts. All right. Let's go to Dan.
So, you know, I think the second example that you read is, you know, it was a lot shorter, which is not always a bad thing. But in this case, I think it was. the first example involved a couple of things that I wanted to flag. So I think, first of all, in the first sentence, you excluded the payment of money from the calculation or of damages or whether the force majeure could be used by that party. And that's an important provision to have in any force majeure paragraph or section of your agreement. Because, you know, if you going to the second example, you don't have that. A person that's party to an agreement that has an obligation to pay money could be excused from paying money because of one of these events. And that's not what force majeure is generally intended to apply to. And that's the reason why you'll see often when, you know, when you're looking at a good force majeure clause that payment will be excluded from that completely. So that's sort of, I guess, just a broader point is that, for our listeners out there, force majeure can't get you out of paying your bills. That is, you know, I think pretty widespread principle. I don't know, Olin.
Well, I was actually just going to jump in and say it can, as long as the party you've contracted with is first relieved of doing whatever they're supposed to do because of something more than just a monetary payment to you. So no, it can't unilaterally get you out of paying your bills or making a payment as you contracted for, but it can retroactively or subsequent to a termination or a relief for the other party.
Gotcha. So if I'm the guy with the tornado boat and you're the guy receiving the shipment, the force majeure could get me out of delivering the shipment, and then as a result of that could get you out of paying me the money for the shipment. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. But assuming I'm the guy making the payment, I can't say, well, the ship burned down and Dan can't do it, therefore I'm not paying him. Only you can invoke that. So if somehow, some other way, you're still able to perform, I can't rely on, as genuine as it might be and as valid as it might be, if that doesn't apply to my impracticability or impossibility of performing, which is simply issuing a check or handing over some cash, I can't use that.
Yeah, lucky for me, I have a backup boat called the Hurricane. And
yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, for that. A few things that I, just as a non-lawyer, will point out when I look at both clauses is, yes, Dan, you're right. You know, brevity isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, it being short is not necessarily a bad thing. But looking at the first example that I read, you know, there are a lot of examples, like, you know, it mentions natural disasters, acts of God, terrorist attacks, governmental laws, all these things. These are all things that I think, you know, in a good clause should be mentioned, right? So in the bad clause, we have no examples. It just says, you know, it's just party shall be liable for any delay or failures. You know, it's not really pointing to anything in particular, which could be good for some people. So let's talk about that. You know, having a clause that isn't very prescriptive, that doesn't give very precise examples, who does that benefit?
So yeah, I think to your point, it depends on what side you're on in the given circumstance. I guess the broader principle that we're sort of talking about here is certainty, right? It's almost always better to remove ambiguity from contracts and insert certainty in its place. So to your point, Wafa, the laundry list of, you know, strikes, riots, natural disasters, acts of God, et cetera, that provides color to the phrase, the general phrase, you know, the whatever this act beyond the party's reasonable control is. So it gives us some options to fall within. It's not an exclusive list, and it shouldn't be, but that's sort of the point. As far as who benefits from a short force majeure provision, or I guess not short, but ambiguous, usually it's going to be the party that needs to invoke the force majeure provision, right? So if there's, you know, on one side of a transaction, you know, the party that needs to perform in some way, let's use an actual example again. So let's go back to building the house, I guess. So if I'm the contractor and Olin's the owner on the house and we have a force majeure provision in our contract, I probably want that force majeure provision to be as this is not the right way to say it, but as ambiguous as possible, as broad as possible, because I'm the one that's going to be having to perform the obligations to build the house, right? And so if something pops up that I might, you know, that justifies the force majeure clause being used, I want a broad provision to be able to invoke that. That it doesn't always work that way, though, because in some instances, me as the contractor, you know, I would say, you know, probably usually, in fact, Olin, you might agree with this or disagree, but I'd probably want a more certain and specific force majeure provision, even on the contractor side in my example, because at least then we going back to the broad principle, at least then we have certainty and we know when both sides know when this could be implicated and when it might not be. And there will be a lot less of a chance of this, you know, potentially being litigated because it's ambiguous.
Yeah, I think in the homeowner, contractor, subcontractor scenario, the only party out of those three who might want a broad, ambiguous one is the homeowner, because as we talked about, his sole obligation is to just hand out cash. And that's far more attenuated from the potential force majeure event than what would impact the contractor or the subcontractor. I want to go back to the quote, the good provision, and kind of just talk about briefly why I like it in terms of COVID. And as you pointed out, it does have specific things, strikes, riots, natural disasters. Now, natural disasters is interesting because what it means in this context and in most contexts you'll see is earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc. You could see a crafty lawyer trying to make an argument that, well, this virus is a natural disaster. And I don't think that argument would go very far, but that's kind of the ambiguity you're trying to get rid of in these provisions, is you don't want to give someone, or you want to give someone, depending on what side you're on, the wiggle room to try to interpret these words as broadly or as specifically as you want. So that's part of what I like about this, is up until you get to the very last part of the specifics, COVID wouldn't be covered. COVID's not a strike. COVID's not a riot. It's not a natural disaster, probably. It's not an act of God. It's not a war. But then you get to governmental laws, regulations, or restrictions which are beyond the control of such party. That's the executive order that we had in Arizona. Interestingly enough, even though the COVID pandemic isn't over, we are starting to reopen. So some businesses are no longer affected by the executive order, while some still are. So with this specific provision we're talking about, it might apply as of last week to some parties and might not apply anymore to them today. And for some parties, it could still apply. So again, it's all about the nuance and the detail you put into it, or the lack thereof, depending on what you want and which side you want to be on.
All right, guys. So now I want to go to COVID-19's effect on force majeure clauses in future contracts. Olin, you can go into that a little.
Yeah, so we've talked about how the current clauses are interpreted or how they have effect. And most of them that I've seen, and Dan, feel free to disagree since you see more contracts than I do, but most of them, if they have a force majeure clause, it's extremely boilerplate. It's just the standard. It's basically that second example that Wafa read. It's just, you know, if something happens that we weren't anticipating, we're released. Is that kind of your experience in most contracts you see?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd say probably 50% of the force majeure clauses that I see are some form of what you just described. The other 50% are a little bit better in that they have some form of the laundry list of strike, labor, dispute, riot, natural disaster, et cetera, attached to them. So that specificity does help, but I would say that in all cases, it's pretty boilerplate.
And so, Dan, what percentage of contracts would you say actually have a force majeure provision, assuming it's appropriate compared to the ones you'd expect or want to have? Is it 50-50? Is it more on the most due, or how does that usually play out?
That's a great question. I would say between sophisticated parties, you know, parties that enter into contracts pretty regularly, 75-25, 75 being that there is a force majeure clause. And then, you know, within that 75%, it gets further broken down as to how good or bad it is.
And to answer your initial question, Wafa, going forward, I expect contracting parties, especially if they've been affected by not having a force majeure clause or having a weak one, to learn from this completely unique worldwide phenomenon. And I anticipate future force majeure provisions in contracts to move away from this boilerplate second example type language that we've seen and be a lot more narrowly tailored to provide protections that cover these types of things and likely other things that people will now start to think about knowing how COVID has affected business and the economy.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. So what can people do if their contract doesn't have a force majeure clause?
So one thing they can do is they can rely on the common law doctrines, which force majeure draws its effect from. And those are the frustration of purpose, impossibility, and impracticability. Dan?
So with frustration of purpose, basically the principle here is that there is some primary purpose of the contract, and both sides understood that to be the case, right? So let me use my bad house example again. So in the house example, the purpose of the contract is to build the house, right? In frustration of purpose, if the purpose, the house being built, is frustrated, meaning there is something, some outside event that comes into play that impacts the ability of that house being built that the parties didn't consider, that's when frustration of purpose can come into play. Let's say that the town that the house is being built in enacts into law a new law that practically at least prohibits the house from being built. You know, whether it's a height restriction or a setback restriction, the house can't be built based on all in your plans as the homeowner because of that new law. That's when frustration of purpose could come into play.
Yeah, and I think an important thing to remember in trying to enforce these provisions in a court of law is that impossibility and impracticability have really high bars for proof. So financial hardship, or just simply the requirement of additional resources to fully perform under the contract, those won't likely be enough to deem impossibility or impracticability. A party seeking to avoid performance must show that to perform would be objectively impossible, not simply unfavorable or difficult. And the same goes for commercial impracticability. Arizona courts have said that to use the doctrine of commercial impracticability, a party must be able to demonstrate that performance under the contract requires, quote, so much beyond the party's contemplation that it becomes an exercise in commercial futility. So clearly it's a pretty high threshold for you to be able to invoke these doctrines and say that there's just no way I could have performed, because a court will say, no, you could have performed. You just wouldn't have made as much money, or it would have been a little more difficult for you to, and that's not enough.
Right, right. And you know, we need to acknowledge here too that if you have to use one of these common law doctrines, it means you're in court, right? Which you don't want to end up there anyway. So, you know, even though there's a high standard of proof or a bar to reach to show these doctrines, separate from that, you can get there a different way on a different road by having that force majeure clause, I think.
All right. Thanks, guys. So like the force majeure clause is the reason hiring an attorney when contemplating entering a contract is so important.
Totally agree. Force majeure is one of the handful of boilerplate provisions in an agreement that can really have profound effects on how smoothly the contract is performed. And in my experience, it really does pay dividends to get out in front of these issues by being thoughtful at the outset during the drafting process. It makes sense in the long run to try to address this stuff at the front.
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. And I'm sure, as you know, with your day to day doing this kind of stuff, the more proactive and nuanced that a party is at the onset of any contractual endeavor, the more likely it is that their involvement with an attorney will probably end with someone like you, a transactional attorney who assists in the formation of the agreement, and then the parties begin performing. And likely they won't need to resort to seeking the assistance of a litigator like myself.
So in other words, people need to decide if they'd rather have a consultation with Dan or Olin.
Pretty much.
Pretty much.
Well, the major takeaway here is that people will need to be more in tune with their contracts, and they will be. People will really focus on that fine print going forward. A lot of times we just really gloss over that fine print, and I think going forward, people are going to pay extra attention to the minor details before signing those contracts. It's really also going to increase everyone's general knowledge on the matter. I mean, before this crisis, I'm sure there were a lot of people who didn't even know what force majeure was, myself, for example. It's now become a pretty commonplace thing, especially if you're dealing with any sort of contract adjustment in the post-COVID-19 world. All right, guys, well, that's all we have for this episode. We hope that you were able to take away something valuable from our conversation. Thank you so much for tuning in, and stay tuned for the next episode.